Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on what did the reformers believe about the Antichrist when we come back. You know, when the federal income tax was launched back in 1913, the tax was levied only on the super wealthy. It was the richest one-half of 1% of our population with a top tax rate of only 7%. Now, today, of course, the fears of those early opponents of the income tax have been more than fully realized. By the end of Herbert Hoover's term, the top tax rate had jumped to over 60%. And by the time Franklin D. Roosevelt was done, the top tax rate was over 90%. And the tax had been dramatically expanded to seize the incomes of the middle class for the first time. Now, back in 1913, the average family had to work until January 30th to earn enough to satisfy the tax man at all levels. This year, the average American family had to work all the way through May 12th in order to earn enough to pay their federal, state, and local tax bills. Now, when you compare this to the plight of medieval serfs, says economist Daniel J. Mitchell, they only had to give the lord of the manor a third of their output and they were considered slaves. Now, what does that make Americans today? This income tax and Social Security tax violate three of the Ten Commandments, they violate eight statutes of the Old Covenant, and they violate our English common law. The income tax and Social Security taxes are two criminal activities. This income tax is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, and Social Security is the eighth plank to the Communist Manifesto. And that's why I contend that you owe it to yourself to at least ask the question, do I really want to participate in this kind of criminal activity? Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, while you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. It's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. Now, our school, Tax and Status, is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, and then just click onto the email machine when you get there. The email section, and then send us a request for that free general law CD package. And once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, last time I reported on the Inquisition, and it was put out by several popes. Quite a little story. It's chapter 14 in a book that's called Babylon Mystery Religion. It's just a short book. It's a paperback, probably 125 pages or so. Probably read it, you know, if you're a normal person, probably read it in a couple hours. Somebody like me, takes me 2 or 3 days, being a slow reader and all. But I did get through it, and I read it all, and it was very enlightening. Very enlightening. I'd heard some of this, kind of vaguely, you know. It's kind of far, far away and long, long ago, you know, that you hear these kinds of things. And I thought I'd give you a history lesson, give you a little report here. During the Middle Ages, there were a lot of reformers, you know, like Calvin and Luther. And we hear stories about these reformers, these Protestant reformers, and they were opposed to the Catholic Church. And, of course, you know, whether you're a Catholic, a Protestant, or a Jew, I guess the curious thing to be asking is, well, why? Why? You don't see people running around today denouncing Roman Catholicism and trying to start some new church. That was done long, long ago. That's a done deal, you know. So if you're a Protestant, does your church teach you about the history? Why did the Lutheran church break away from the Roman Catholic Church. What was in their minds? What were they thinking? Especially in light of the Inquisition. I mean, breaking away from the Catholic Church could get you killed. And it didn't kill everybody. It didn't get everybody, as evidenced by the fact that you've got Lutherans and Presbyterians and Baptists today. So this war against Protestantism failed. Failed. I wouldn't say that it failed miserably. The Catholic Church has about 1 billion people. That's about one person out of every six is a member of the Catholic Church. In the last numbers I saw, all of Protestantism combined worldwide only represents about 300 million people, about the population of the United States. So when you go to South America, for instance, and you take a look at the religious breakdown of the people down there, you know, they're about 90-some percent, I don't know exactly, but 90% plus Catholic, and then all others. If you go to the Philippines as an illustration, they're all Catholic. I mean, it doesn't mean there aren't a few Baptists there, but you know, as a percentage of the population, they're not very many of them. You go to Europe, you find France, they're all Catholic. Ireland, they're all Catholic. In England, they're about half. Germany, about half. But you find there are whole countries like Italy, you know, they're all Catholic. You know, the whole country is Catholic. Poland, the whole country is Catholic. And so you take a look at those and you say, that's kind of telling. Now, there's other brands of Christian. I mean, you know, we got our Western brand of Christian. And the Greeks, you know, they've got their brand. And then there's the Russians, they've got their brand of Christian, you know, they're a little different breed of cat. The Jews, they don't amount to very much. There's only about 15 or 20 million of them around the world. They're not very many of those. They're pretty distinct, though. I mean, you know, they're not out here trying to figure out where they came from. They all know. But the Protestants over here, I don't think the average Protestant knows much about what the Protestant leaders of the Middle Ages believed and what they taught, and many of them were tortured to death. Luther wasn't. He died of old age, but most of them, many of them, died, and they died hard. Many suppose that the word Antichrist simply means one who is against Christ, but there have been millions of people, Jews, pagans, and members of non-Christian religions, who in varying degrees have been against Christ. We believe the biblical designation is more specific than this. The word Antichrist can mean against, in opposition to Christ, or it can mean instead of or in place of Christ, or three, it can contain both meanings. Eliot has written, when anti is compounded with the noun signifying an agent of any kind or functionary, the compound word either signifies a vice functionary or a functionary of the same kind opposing or sometimes both. Opposing or functioning as. Now, an example of the word having both meanings is found right within the terminology of the Roman Catholic Church. At times, two men would claim to be the Pope at the same time. The one who was considered a hostile, self-substituted, or usurping Pope was called an anti-Pope. Such a pope positioned himself in place of the pope as if he were the pope, but was as such against the pope. Thus he was called the anti-pope. Now for a man, then, to claim to be the head of the church in place of Christ, what is this but to be in reality against Christ or anti-Christ? The reason for this is simple. Christ alone is the head of the church, as we see in Ephesians 4, verses 15 and 16. And in Ephesians 5, verse 23, and Colossians 1, verse 18. So the Bible has a definition for the head of the church. And it says Christ alone is the head of the church. Now, many Christians today are totally unaware of this issue, but in earlier times, Protestant creeds emphasized that it is Christ and not the Pope who is the head of the church. the wording of the Westminster Confession of Faith in Chapter 26, Section 6, is very typical of this position. And it says, quote, "There is no other head of the Church but the Lord Jesus Christ, nor can the Pope of Rome in any sense be head thereof, but is that Antichrist, that man of sin, that son of perdition, that exalteth himself in the Church against Christ and all that is called God," unquote. Now, while it is true that other churches and other ministries have leaders, what is claimed for the Pope goes far beyond simply being in place or a place of leadership. Has any other religious leader ever been so brazen as to claim that he is the head of the Church, that he is in the place of Christ on earth, and such other papal claims? Well, on April the 30th, 1922, in the Vatican throne room, before a throng of cardinals, bishops, priests, and nuns, who fell on their knees before him, Pope Pius the 11th, in haughty tones, said, "You know that I am the Holy Father, the representative of God on earth, the vicar of Christ, which means that I am God on the earth," unquote. The pagan Caesar was called our Lord and God. For centuries, the popes accepted the same title. On the arch, raised in honor of Pope Borgia, were the words, quote, Rome was great under Caesar. Now she is greater. Alexander the Sixth reigns. The former was a man. This is a god." Pope Pius X, when Archbishop of Venice, said, quote, "The Pope is not only the representative of Jesus Christ, he is Jesus Christ himself, hidden under the veil of the flesh. Does the Pope speak? It is Jesus Christ who speaks," unquote. Well, at the coronation of Pope Innocent X, the following words were addressed to him by a cardinal who knelt before him. The cardinal said, quote, "Most holy and blessed Father, head of the Church, ruler of the world, to whom the keys of the kingdom of heaven are committed, whom the angels in heaven revere, and the gates of hell fear, and all the world adores, we specially venerate, worship, and adore thee," unquote. Moreri, a noted historian, wrote, quote, "To make war against the Pope is to make war against God, seeing the Pope is God and God is the Pope." Decius said, quote, "The Pope can do all things that God can do. Pope Leo XIII said of himself in 1890, the supreme teacher in the Church is the Roman Pontiff. Union of minds, therefore, requires together, with a perfect accord in the one faith, complete submission and obedience of will to the Church and to the Roman Pontiff as to God himself." Now consider the following excerpts from actual wording that has been used by the popes. "The Roman Pontiff judges all men, but is judged by no one. We declare to be subject to the Roman Pontiff is to every creature altogether necessary for salvation. That which was spoken of Christ, thou hast subdued all things under his feet, may well seem verified in me. I have the authority of the King of Kings. I am all in all and above all. I am able to do almost all that God can do. Wherefore, no marvel if it be in my power to change time and times, to alter and abrogate laws, to dispense with all things, yea, with the precepts of Christ. For where Christ biddeth Peter to put up his sword and admonishes his disciples not to use any outward force in revenging themselves, so do not I." Pope Nicholas, writing to the bishops of France, "exhort them to draw out their material swords. Wherefore, as I began, so I conclude, commanding, declaring, and pronouncing to stand upon necessity of salvation for every creature to be subject to me." unquote. Now, those are statements that were made by popes at one time or another that have been cited from the Catholic Encyclopedia. Now, most of the citations that are made here in this book come from the Catholic Encyclopedia. So what this author has done is he's taken the admissions that came out of the Catholic's own mouth. Very important legal principle. A confession, you know, is worth far more than the adverse testimony of witnesses who may be partisan. You know, it's one thing for, you know, five people to come in and testify against Saddam Hussein. It would be 10 times more powerful for Saddam Hussein to testify out of his own mouth to the things that he'd done. And these are confessions. These are statements. These aren't contrived, quotes that come from John Hagee or some Protestant preacher over here with an axe to grind. These are the exact statements that come out of the mouths of various popes that are cited in their bulls or cited in their communiques and then reported in the Catholic Encyclopedia. So we didn't go to the Encyclopedia Britannica now and pull out a bunch of bad stuff against Catholics over here. I just think it's a good historical lesson to hear from the people in charge what it was that they were thinking and what they were doing, and why it was that so many of these people who were at one time Catholics revolted against the Catholic Church and said, hey, wait a minute, this is unscriptural and we're going to break away from this. And why it was that these people endured death in some of the most inhuman ways possible through torture. I admire somebody that can sit there and go to his death and refuse to recant what he has said because of his faith, because of his belief in the Scripture, because of his belief in God. That is phenomenal. You know, when you torture somebody, you know, you can just about make anybody say anything that you want them to say if you apply enough pressure. Here in America, for you people around the world, here in America, when the police arrest you and they take you in and torture you, they don't call that torture. They call that pain compliance. They have a word for it. Here in America, we call it pain compliance. I've been through that. I never went through pain compliance to the level that these martyrs in the Middle Ages did. You know, if you take torture today in American jails and prisons, compared to the torture of the Middle Ages perpetrated upon heretics by the Catholics and the Catholic Church, the civil authorities of the day, I mean, they're pikers today compared to what they were in the past. I wouldn't call it any less torture just because the modality of inflicting pain for the purposes of getting you to comply with this or that or something else that the police want you to comply with. They want you to confess. They want you to sign this confession, and so they apply pain to you. See, that's strictly prohibited in Miranda versus Arizona. You know, here in America, we have the Supreme Court and we have our judicial processes and one thing and another. That doesn't mean that all of the police follow Miranda versus Arizona. I can tell you personally from personal experience that that isn't so. Police routinely use pain compliance. Torture, you know, in common terms. But it's not the kind of torture that you see, you know, in the history books talking about the Middle Ages and the Catholic popes and their bulls and so on. But it's torture nevertheless. It's applied pain. I remember one guy, his name was Larry Richards. He was Chuck Palmer's administrative assistant. And there was about 6 or 8 of these Ada County sheriff's deputies, and they were trying to take my fingerprints. And I said, well, boys, I'd be happy to give you my fingerprints. What I want you to do is to comply with the Supreme Court rule in Davis versus Mississippi. I want you to get a court order first. And so Larry Richards, you know, he was a lawyer before he became Palmer's administrative assistant. So he said, we don't need any damn court order to take your fingerprints. And then he instructed the others. He says, don't make any marks on him. That's because I'm a civil rights activist. And, you know, if you make marks on me, I'll get witnesses, and then I'll come in and sue you, and then I'll bring in my marks and these bruises to prove that you used overzealous police practice. And so Richards knew that. So he says, don't make any marks on him. Boys and girls, I can testify today that I hurt real bad for 2 weeks. 2 weeks I hurt. There was not a mark on my body. Not a mark. No bruises. No broken blood vessels. When those boys got through with me, I couldn't walk. Not under my own power. Just thought I'd share it with you. So, you know, when I hear my president stand up in front of the news media and say, "We Americans don't torture people." You know, he's probably telling the truth. He's probably, you know, on the same level, about the same level, I would say, as Bill Clinton saying, "I did not have sex with that woman." He didn't have vaginal sex. They called it something else. Perverted sex. Oral sex. But I didn't have sex with that woman. Our president, he's probably telling the truth. You know, when you take somebody out of Italy and you send him to Egypt and the Egyptians torture him and then the information is given to the Americans, I guess our president can stand up and say, "We Americans do not torture people." Of course not. We send them off to Egypt to have them tortured. But we haul them there in American airplanes. We use American CIA agents to kidnap them off the streets of Italy. But then, of course, those are Muslims. And it's okay to torture Muslims. Isn't it? Hell, I want to report to you that we got the same kind of torture going on here in the United States. I don't know that we're as effective. I don't know that Americans are as good as it as the Syrians or the Egyptians or the Chinese or somebody else. I don't know who the most effective are, but I'll tell you, these Catholics aren't pikers. Or at least they weren't years ago. So when we take a look at the following excerpts from the actual wording that has been used by the popes declaring themselves to be gods or themselves to be in the place of God, and then the Catholic people, they follow these edicts. They actually believe this. One pope that I read, I think it was Pope somebody, the 11th, Clement the 11th, around this time, around the 11th or 12th century, said, "You give me a child until he's 7, and he will be a Catholic for life." Now, that's brainwashing, I would say. But then, you know, the other religious people of the world, they do the same thing. You know, you train a kid up as a Muslim, you know, and that, you know, when he's 30 years old, he won't depart from it. In fact, God himself in the Bible says that if you train up a child in the way he should go when he is old, he will not depart from it. So it's kind of like a dog, you know. If you catch a puppy and you train him, you know, when he's a puppy, he'll remember that when he's an old dog. So you train him when they're young. Well, Catholics aren't any different than Muslims or anybody else in that regard. Now, with these kinds of arrogant claims, you know, like I'm God and I sit in the place of God and I rule and I can change laws and times and seasons, with these kinds of arrogant claims as these being made, it is no wonder that, as Froome, F-R-O-O-M, has written, quote, "In the centuries just preceding the Reformation, an ever-increasing number of pious persons began openly to express the conviction that the dire prophecies concerning Antichrist in the Bible were even then in the process of fulfillment. They felt, they believed that the falling away had already taken place. They declared that Antichrist was already seated in the church temple of God, clothed in scarlet and purple." Eberhard II, the Archbishop of Salzburg from 1200 to 1246, set forth the teaching that the little horn of Daniel 7 was the Pope, who was a wolf in shepherd's garb, the Antichrist, the son of perdition, and he was excommunicated by the Pope and he died under the ban in 1246. So this guy is an Archbishop of Salzburg. He died when he was 46 years old. He died a martyr because he took a look at the scripture. He was a Catholic. He took a look at the scripture and he said, I think this Pope, based upon what I see in the Bible, is in fact the Antichrist. This, of course, triggered the wrath of the Pope. Now, when people said of Jesus, can you remember in Sunday school, Jesus was talking in a country, in Judea, where he was not popular. And he was a religious dissident. And from time to time, he would say, you Pharisees over here are whitened sepulchers. He said that they were wicked. He said they were satanic. He said that they would do the deeds of their father, Satan the devil. He called them satanic. He called them a lot of things. And in the end, they put him to death. But can you ever recall Jesus saying, we need to kill all these Pharisees, we need to murder these people because they don't believe like we do? Can you ever remember that anywhere in the Bible, where Jesus called upon his followers to kill people? That's the thing that in the last report that I gave to you was so shocking to me. You know, I'm an old man. I'm not easily shocked. When I saw Bill Moyer's report on John Hagee, I want to give you that name again. This John Hagee now is a Christian preacher in San Antonio, Texas, who is calling for a preemptive strike against Iran. And I'm reporting what I heard Hagee say on the report of Bill Moyers. I would suggest that you call PBS, Bill Moyers report, and what you're looking for is the Friday night. It was aired on October the 5th. Friday night, October the 5th. Well, at least it was here on AETN. And you can listen to it for yourself. I thought Christians, by and large, Catholics and Protestants and Jews, you know, were by and large, at least publicly, against war and would say, no, I don't think we ought to go to war unless we're attacked or unless there's some vital need. I mean, these people are advocating a preemptive strike against Iran. We Americans have always, at least in my lifetime, maintained the position that we would never strike Russia first, but that we were going to maintain a deterrent to the Russians, and that if you guys ever attack us, now you want to know ahead of time that you're going to get hurt real bad in return, but that we're not going to attack you first. In fact, I think that that's what we see in the Bible. I don't think that preemptive attacks and strikes, you know, are called for. But again, I just want to be a reporter here and report to you. Now, going back here to the Middle Ages again, John Fox, a fellow by the name of F-O-X-E, John Fox. He's a noted writer of Fox's Book of Martyrs. And he gives a list of learned men between 1331 and 1360. Now I want you to notice here that this first martyr here was born in 1200 and died in 1246. In Fox's Book of Martyrs, he's talking about 1331. If you'll remember in my last report, I said that this Inquisition, these murders that went on, it wasn't just an aberrant pope like Adolf Hitler, who went nuts for 13 years, like Adolf Hitler, between 1933 and 45 and killed a bunch of people. This was systemic in the Catholic Church from about 1209, which is the beginning year that I can see when this first bull was published, 1209. And here we can see in Fox's Book of Martyrs extends at least to 1360. We're talking about 150 years here. 150. It actually goes on clear up into the 1600s and up to the 17th century. So we're talking the 1200s, the 1300s, the 1400s, 1500s, and 1600s. 500 years. Well, you know, in 500 years, you know, you kill 60,000 here and 500 there and 5,000 someplace else, and you do that for 500 years. And pretty soon, you know, you can get up to 100 million people. Remember, a million now is a bunch of people. No, Adolf Hitler, you know, it's reported, killed 6 million Jews. Hell, he killed 13 million people total. I mean, that's just going out and killing them. So, you know, if you Jews think that you were put upon, well, there were 7 million other people he killed also. I mean, those are the reports we get. And that's what I'm reading from various sources. Now, I'm looking at 150 years of history. Here's John Fox. And he says, between 1331 and 1360, these people contended against the false claims of the Pope. One of these, Michael of Cesena, C-E-S-E-N-A, who had numerous followers, not a few of whom were slain, declared the Pope to be Antichrist and the Church of Rome to be the whore of Babylon, drunk with the blood of the saints, unquote. A fellow by the name of John Wycliffe, sometimes spelled W-Y-C-L-I-F-F-E, noted English reformer, taught that the persecuting little horn of Daniel had found fulfillment in the papacy, which arose out of the fourth kingdom, Rome. Why is it necessary in unbelief to look for another Antichrist? He asked. In the seventh chapter of Daniel, Antichrist is forcefully described by a horn arising in the time of the fourth kingdom, wearing out the saints of the Most High. His book, The Mirror of Antichrist, is filled with references to the Pope as Antichrist. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, we're talking about reformers, the Protestant reformers. How many Protestant reformers are there? Well, let me just count them up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 9, 9, 9, 10, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 20, 20, 21, 21, 21, 21. And he's got 21 here in the book, which is entitled Babylon Mystery Religion. 21 of the Middle Age reformers, men like Wycliffe and Luther and Huss, 21 of them over here, every single one of them identified the Pope as the Antichrist. Some of these people didn't even speak English. Some of them were German reformers, Italian reformers, German. Luther was a German. Wycliffe was an Englishman. And I wouldn't say every single reformer. I don't know how many of these Protestant reformers there were. But he's got 21 of them listed here in this report. And every single one of these guys is reporting that they believed in the Middle Ages that the Pope was the Antichrist, holding himself out to be God, claiming to be God. Well, isn't that just real special? Yeah, I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and that the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. We're open to individuals by prearrangement, and the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on our website. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417 217-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements are recommendations that we give out. Do not mean that those authors and publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate and recommend the Law Hour and Editorial Review, because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour, they may be political, hostile, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans. And, quite frankly, we do not necessarily endorse the viewpoints of everybody that we endorse portions of what they write and say here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, and they're mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, remember our website is georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are taking a look here at the Antichrist and what the Reformers had to say about what they believed Antichrist in the Bible meant. 21 Reformers, including John Wycliffe, Martin Luther, John Huss, and others, believed that it was the Pope that is the Antichrist. Now, I made a report here one time on the Antichrist in a cup of tea. You can pick that off of our archives, in which the author of that book thought that the Antichrist would be the man of sin. This man of sin, Antichrist, would be Prince Charles. Pretty good story. Pretty good argument. I have to say, I don't know. I'm persuaded that there is an Antichrist coming, and the book, The Antichrist and a Cup of Tea, identifying Prince Charles, made a good case. Good case. And these Reformers, they all make a good case. And I come along and I say, well, I read the Bible, and I say the Bible tells us that that's what's going to occur here in the end times, and we're going to have this Antichrist who's going to be thrown in the lake of fire. Is it the Pope who's reigning at that time? Is he the Antichrist? Has this Antichrist been around for hundreds of years, thousands of years now, in the form of the Pope? Makes a pretty good argument. I'm not going to hit every one of these arguments, so I'm going to tell you that the book is called Babylon Mystery Religion. It's written by a fellow by the name of Ralph Woodrow. First published in 1966. This is the 27th edition, copyrighted in 1993. 27 editions. Doesn't say how many books have been printed. Could be that they had 27 editions of 100 copies each, and so there's 2,700 of them out there. I don't know. Could be 27 million, 27,000. I can't tell you, but he makes a pretty compelling argument. And the historical references and footnotes that he puts in here I thought were pretty compelling also. And his citations that come out of the books written by John Wycliffe and Fox's Book of Martyrs, I mean, the guy isn't, you know, talking off the top of his head here. No, he's telling you the straight skinny. And he's giving us a history lesson. And the history lesson is this. Religious people ought to scare the living hell out of you. And if they don't, you haven't been paying attention to history. Religious people scare the hell out of me. Hillary Clinton doesn't seem to be very religious. I'm not too concerned about Hillary. But boy, I'm telling you, this guy, John Hagee, that was scary. I saw that on Bill Moyers the other day. I don't think I've ever listened to a Christian before that scared me quite the way this guy John Hagee did. Now, these Muslims over here are scary. You know, when people strap bombs on themselves and blow themselves up so they can get 70 virgins in hell, in heaven, if that doesn't scare you, boy, I'm telling you, you got to be a Rambo. That's pretty scary. But this guy Hagee over here, now, you know, other than, you know, if you don't believe me, you're going to go to hell and burn for all of eternity. I've heard that, you know, from preachers, you know, from the time I was a little kid. That isn't too scary. That doesn't bother me. The Middle Ages is pretty scary, torturing people to death. I worry that the religious people are going to get control again, like they do in Iran. You know, when religious people get control of the government, in Iraq, you know, you people were complaining about Saddam Hussein and the repression, the secular repression that you got from there. I would almost venture a guess and say that Hitler's Nazi Germany wasn't anywhere near as bad as the Middle Ages in Europe under the popes. You know, if you just keep your mouth shut and don't run around saying too much, you know, you can live a long time. And Hitler would kill you. And I don't deny that. But I don't remember that the Nazis were out here putting people on the rack and torturing them to death. They put them in rooms and they gassed them to death. But you know, how long does it take you to suffocate by gas? You know, it takes maybe 5 minutes. And I'm sure that dying is a very painful, very gruesome process. I haven't experienced it personally, but the Bible calls it the sting of death. Death is a sting. Well, if you've ever been stung by a bee or a wasp, a hornet, yellow jacket, it hurts. A sting hurts. No doubt about it. But you know, when you burn somebody to death at the stake, it looks like to me a little bit more than a sting. When you choke somebody to death, you know, it's over in about, I'd say about 2 minutes. 5 minutes for sure. When you drown, you know, you're being choked to death. That doesn't sound like a very good way to die, but you know, it isn't like stretching you out on a rack and pulling your arms off of your body. Now that strikes me as being cruel and inhuman. And that's the report that we get here from Fox's Book of Martyrs. We get it from the Catholic Encyclopedia. We get it from the early Protestant reformers. They were writing of the history of the day. Here's a couple of others. A guy by the name of Walter Brute, he's a noted scholar, prophetic expositor, and associate of Wycliffe, was accused in 1391 of oft-times and commonly claiming that the Pope is Antichrist and a seducer of the people. John Oldcastle, 1360 to 1417, famous Christian of the Herefordshire, spoke of the Pope in these words. He said, quote, "I know him by the Scriptures to be the great Antichrist. Rome is the very nest of Antichrist, and out of that nest come all of the disciples of him. He was sentenced to death for naming Antichrist. He was dragged to St. Giles, suspended in chains, and slowly burned to death as his voice ascended in praise of God." I'm a firm believer in freedom of speech. And oftentimes people will write hateful things about me. And it hurts. And I got to tell you that when you receive an email, when you read something in a newspaper about you that's derogatory, it feels real bad. And the other day I saw something that was especially hurtful on I think it was the McLaughlin Group, or it perhaps was on something else. On Friday night, I try to listen to all the news programs on PBS, and it was about Hillary Clinton. And it was about one of the most hurtful things I think I've ever seen. It was about Hillary's cackle. Clinton, they call it the Clinton cackle. Hillary Clinton laughs. You know, when people laugh, they have a distinct laugh. You know, it's just the way people are. everybody's laugh is different. Just like their voice is different. When somebody calls you on the telephone, you know, that's very distinctive. Somebody calls me on the phone, he doesn't have to say, "This is John Jones over here. Hey, John, how you doing?" I can recognize his voice. And then when people laugh, I can oftentimes recognize their laugh. And I'd never thought much about Hillary Clinton's laugh. It never entered my mind until this derogatory piece came on over Hillary Clinton. Now, I can tell you, I'm no champion of Hillary Clinton. She's a communist. She's a socialist. She represents every political evil that I loathe. But I got to tell you that when I saw this piece, I was really shocked because they put on about 10 clips of Hillary laughing in various, you know, clips. And when you're running for president, every word that you say is being videotaped. And then they go back and they take the videotapes and they pull out statements that you make out of context. They'll make a statement, 10 words that you said, but they don't tell the next 15 words after that that qualifies what you've just said to make you look bad. And they do it on purpose. It's a lie is what it is. And they just do that to make their opponent look bad so that you won't vote for them. Well, they took Hillary Clinton's laugh, and maybe she's got a bad laugh, and maybe you shouldn't vote for her because of the way she laughs, but it's hurtful, I want to tell you. And it's just totally uncalled for. She may be wicked. She may be evil. I believe she's a lesbian. She's a communist. She's a socialist. She's perverse. There's 55 truthful reasons why you should not vote for Hillary Clinton. But when they pulled out her laugh, I said to myself, is it because these people are so inept, so incompetent, that they can't pull out what she's really guilty of? What she really believes, what she really means, what she really stands for? I don't know how Martin Luther laughed. I don't know how John Wycliffe laughed. I don't know. Maybe they were cacklers. I can't tell you. But they wrote historical accounts of what occurred. And when you say things that are hurtful, it's hurtful. I mean, that's just the way life is. And then when you take somebody out and you torture this guy to death in an inhuman way, that is, it's bad enough that you have to kill this guy because he's bad. And maybe these heretics needed to be killed. But I would be the first to deny that they needed to be put to death in these horrendous, barbaric modalities. Just because you didn't like them or you didn't agree with them. I think free speech is probably one of the most valuable rights that we Americans have. And that's why I'm so vociferous against Jews with their loathsome hate crimes and hate speech legislation. God, I hate that. Hate crimes and hate speech. Because this is the absolute epitome of what happens when you get to the point where you enact hate crimes and hate speech. And we're doing that, boys and girls. And every time you do that, somebody's going to come out here and they're going to say something and we're going to put them in jail. Pretty soon, jail won't be enough. Pretty soon, we're going to have to put them to death. And pretty soon, putting them to death isn't going to be enough. Pretty soon, we're going to have to torture these people to death. And who is it that's doing this? It's the religious people that are doing it. The religious people. That's why I've said, you know, these religious people just scare the hell out of me. Now, there's a little more to this. A fellow by the name of John Huss, he was born in Bohemia. He was a well-educated man who came under the influence of Wycliffe's writings, which caused him to break with the Church of Rome. He labeled the Pope as the Antichrist, of which the Scriptures had warned. His writings constantly refer to Antichrist as the enemy of the Church. Not as a Jew, not as a pagan, not as a Turk, but as a false confessor of the name of Christ. Pope Martin V issued a bull in 1418 in which he ordered the punishment of men or women who held to the teachings of Wycliffe and Huss 60 miles from Prague On a steep mountain, the city of Tabor was built, to which the Hussites could flee from the Antichrist, the Pope. Huss himself was condemned as a heretic and delivered to the secular arm for execution. Accompanied by a guard of 1,000 armed men and a vast crowd of spectators, he was led through the churchyard, where he saw a bonfire of his books in the public square. As he knelt and prayed, his hands were tied behind him, and a rusty chain was wound around his neck. Straw and wood were piled around him. The name Huss meant goose in the Bohemian tongue. And at the place of execution, Huss reportedly said, "This day ye are burning a goose, but from my ashes will arise a swan, which you will not be able to roast," an expression later quoted by Luther. Huss began to sing, writes Froom, "but the wind swept the flames into his face and silenced his words, and only his lips moved until they too were stilled in death for his stand against the Antichrist of Bible prophecy." Boy, that takes a lot of grit. It's got more grit than I got. Martin Luther. I want you to notice the dates here. This guy Huss is put to death in 1418. Now these inquisitions began in 1209, and here we are up to 1418. This is Pope Martin V. So, Pope Martin V is just one pope in a long succession of popes. And this is the point I wanted to make to you. This wasn't the aberrant behavior of one madman like Saddam Hussein or an Adolf Hitler. This was a systemic persecution of people because of their religious beliefs. I think this is a very valuable historical lesson for every Catholic that draws breath. Because I don't think that the average Catholic, and you know, I got a lot of friends that are Catholic, just like you do. But I don't think the average Catholic would see himself as a person who would go out and put somebody to some kind of an inhuman death like this. And yet I reported to you in the last report, there are 70 million, let me repeat that, 70 million evangelical Christians who support Israel. And I'm not opposed to the political support of Israel or France or Germany or China. You know, politics is your belief in life. But to support a preemptive war against a nation of 36 million people because of their beliefs, because of their practices. Wars, boys and girls, are not selective. The popes here are selecting leaders and killing them in an inhumane way. I'm reporting to you that 70 million Christians are advocating. They are now beating the war drum. They're telling us we need to go to war against Iran. I want a dissent from that view. I don't want to go to war against Iran. I don't want to go to war against anybody. Wars are very indiscriminate modalities of killing people. You know, dropping bombs like the atomic bomb on a city like Hiroshima is very indiscriminate in the way it kills people. There probably are a lot of bad people that need killing. At least the popes, when they saw bad people that needed killing, were not indiscriminate. They discriminated by zeroing in on the exact people that they believed needed to be killed. And then they killed them. These were called Protestants. Now, as horrible as that may sound, going to war against a nation of people kills men, women, and children. And while Hitler is a bad guy, going to war against Germany killed a lot of men, women, and children that didn't have anything to do with Adolf Hitler, and indeed, probably, were opposed to him. I would suggest, boys and girls, we need to think this through a little bit further. In 1 Samuel chapter 8, when our people went to Samuel and said, "We want a king like all the nations around us," our God cautioned us at that time. He said, let me suggest to you that you go back and think about this. This is a big step. This is an irreversible step. Once you make this step and you select a new king, you are going to make a step that you cannot correct. You know, once we decided to go to war against the Iraqis, now we're involved in a sticky mess like the tar baby. You know, it's the tar baby in Iraq. Are you really sure that you want to get involved with another tar baby in Iran? You got tar baby number one in Afghanistan, tar baby number two in Iraq. Are you honest to God sure that you need another tar baby over here in Iran? I'd like to add my voice of caution and say I'm not really sure that that's a very wise move. In fact, I'm going to go a step further and point out that I dissent. Don't count me in that gang. And that's why I've reported here in the past, I'm not a Christian. And I want to disassociate myself from Christianity. I want to get as far away from Christianity as I can get. Now, I don't subscribe to Judaism and I don't subscribe to Muslimism, but I'm reporting to you that Christians have killed more people throughout the ages than any other civilization in the history of mankind. Now, Christians like to pride themselves, at least as long as I've been alive, in my nearly 70 years, prided themselves on their belief in Jesus, the humble carpenter of Nazareth, and turn the other cheek, and the Ten Commandments, and to obey God and keep His commandments. Boys and girls, there's a law in the Bible that deals with war, and it requires the authority of God Almighty Himself before you go to war. 70 million Christians are a big bunch of people. And 14 million of them are hardcore, and they're advocating that we go to war. John Hagee is probably a nice guy. I'm not sitting here arguing about, you know, nice guys. But when you get to the point where you're telling people, we need to go to war, we need to start killing people in Iran, I say, we need to rethink that. Hey, we're about out of time here, boys and girls. I got to give you a final reminder that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then please go to our homeschooling page on our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, we're out of time. I got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. And good night, friends.